Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Andy, it's James.
Hey, James, how are you doing?
Pretty good. So I'm going to just...
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. I'm going to do an intro and I'll bring you in. Well, you're already here, so... All right, here we go. Welcome to Wake Up 9/11 Radio. I'm your host, James Easton, and tonight with me I have Andy, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories, 9/11, and the points of impact, evidence of 9/11 with regards to planes, or lack of evidence. Andy, how are you doing?
Real fine, thanks a lot, and I'm glad to be on board here a little bit. Hopefully I can provide a little bit of insight for help clear up some things from some people, and no doubt probably a little controversy on top of it.
Very good. So let's start with what was your experience on 9/11 when you saw the airplane hit the tower? Like, basically, what happened?
The setting I was in, I was in a classroom, a high school classroom. I was a teaching assistant. I'd been overseas for a number of years. When I came back, I got a job in the local school system. During the morning, principal came on the PA system and asked all teachers to turn on their TVs and sat there and watched the North Tower smoking. And, of course, at that time, there was no evidence of no introduction that a plane was happening, and we were sitting there watching it, and the kids were doing their lessons. And suddenly, kaboom, in comes allegedly Flight 175 out from the right, and everybody just went bananas. And even the teacher that I was helping said said a swear word they don't usually use in the classroom. And we sat there for the rest of the morning, just in awe of what was going on. And of course, the reports of other planes being hijacked, and the story was just getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And so it was a very shocking experience. So, you know, that's how it was introduced to me. And I think I went on for the next 8 or 9 years with that image in my mind and always thinking about how America had been attacked. Right. And it wasn't until I was introduced to a film by a friend who I was calling one of those crazy conspiracy theorists, and he says, "Well, just watch this 5-minute film, and tell me whether or not you know you're going to change your mind." And the film that he introduced, of course, was James Corbett's 9/11 conspiracy theory. It's a right. kind of a joke, a parody on the official story, and. And of course, when I first watched it, I didn't believe it. I thought it was just more garbage. He was introducing so many things that I wasn't aware of. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to look up some of these things that he's talking about, and you know, the people involved, and the operations that were going on. And the more I was looking into it, I thought, well, the guy's starting to make sense here. And right. And then I think one of the things that really turned my head was. Building 7 and Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. Those two particular okay. things were my, my shining light that thought, wait, something's not right here. And from there, the whole story started falling apart.
All right, that's cool. I mean, there are so many problems with the story that it's easy to pull it apart at the seams kind of thing. I know... My first impression was that those towers came down too quickly and, you know, just not at the acceleration due to gravity. You just have to do a little math, you know, look up the height of the tower and speed of gravity. The acceleration due to gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared or 3.2 feet per second squared. And the tower came down in 11 seconds. So
right.
that's basically... like they free fell to the ground. But also looking at the footage, seeing the floors blow out like every like in sections and chunks, like three floors, boom, 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 boom. And, you know, later on down the road, I got to see a lot more footage, and it only just confirmed my idea. But so you have a different angle to this, and you also are interested in the evidence that, I mean, what evidence there is to say that it's not what they said it was. So let's get into that.
Quite frankly, every aspect of the official story of 9/11 comes under suspicion once you start opening up that gate, or once you start pulling the bottom cards out of that house of cards and it starts all collapsing at once. Then virtually nothing of the official story has, in my mind, has proven to be evidence. And yet people still believe the official story from the 9/11 Commission and the NIST report, and they defend it to one degree or another. And quite frankly, like I say, for almost a decade, I used to be a sheeple. I saw along those lines. I found myself going into a family restaurant and seeing soldiers in their uniforms and giving them an artificial little salute and saying, thank you for helping us fight the terrorists and everything. You know, I was full blow into that. And I always thought that was a bit shocking, because back in the 70s, I was sort of anti-Vietnam War. And, you know, I thought to myself, boy, I'm going full circle here. I'm going, you know, from being against the war to now going out there and making sure they all turn to glass. So for me to make that conversion from following the official story and defending basically something I didn't understand to doing an in-depth study on a, you know, case by case and scene by scene and venue by venue and flight by flight instance, I'm saying this story has got so many holes. So yeah, I was a sheeple. So that's why when I talk to people that still are where I used to be, you know, I don't want to be abusive to them. I want to educate them. I want to pull them over. I want to give them the opportunity to open up the same doors I did.
Okay. Personally, I mean, I see a great sense of urgency, because if this is the kind of thing they're doing to elicit some kind of, I don't know, to the way I put it is they're rolling out their plan,
right.
And you can see this all the false flags that have come after, what's the means to an end? What's going to be the end? what are they planning? And I think that it's been too long that so many people are resigned to the idea that the official story is the right one, even though it's full of holes. They either don't care anymore, they say, oh, that was too long ago, and, you know, get over it kind of thing, or they're just lazy and uninterested and unaware of how impacting this is on the lives of other people in the world. And so I've been working at this for 3.5 years solid, and made a bunch of movies, and the whole point of it was to inform and educate. I'm a little more rough with people, you know, like kick them and wake them, you know, like I used to say, give them a smack upside the head and, you know, smack them out of their complacency. But that doesn't fly too well with some people. It works, yeah. Though. But I think the best way is probably your way, to be genial, friendly, and approachable, and give education to people on the subject in a non-confrontational way, which that works for, I think, for older people, I think. Like, I'm in Generation X. People that are older are typically, I don't know, bound to the television, and they believe everything that it says. So what do you think?
Well, to touch on one topic is that, you know, when people say, you know, gee, that was 15, 16 years ago, you know, that's all over with. And I say, yes, but the consequences of that day are amplified almost in a radial direction around the world, and that ripple is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon that ripple is going to come back at us. The very weapons that we use in the countries that we justified attacking because of 9/11 will someday return home to us. You know, the police are being militarized. There's already drone operations in the United States for surveillance problems, and it doesn't take much more to arm them with weapons. So what we've been doing overseas, what the United States has been doing overseas, I don't want to say we because that sounds like I'm taking credit for it, but so what the United States has been doing overseas to other countries will someday return home to us, and this is a great fear, and so you know I look at them and I think, well, yeah, apathy is a very effective method. You know, it's one thing to be apathetic, but to be apathetic about being apathetic is just plain pathetic because, you know, you don't even care that you don't care. You know, so
right.
So that's the one issue here. And you know, I hate attaching labels to anybody or grouping them into some kind of sphere because that's one of the things that starts dividing truthers. You're a planer, you're no planer, you're a DEW, you're a nuker, you're a thermite, blah, 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 blah. There's, you know, everyone wants to argue the little minutia. Everyone wants to present that their theory is the right theory. You know, I tend to take a little different approach. I'm not looking for the truth. I'm trying to reveal, expose the lie. See, once,
right.
You know, for every lie, there's 1,000 so-called, you know, theories of the truth. So when all you really need to do, all I really try to focus on is look at what's not there that should be there rather than what's not there what I think should be there. So that's kind of the approach I have. But as far as labels, I was going to say, you know, what we come across are we have your truthers and your conspiracy theorists, you have your sheeple, your shills, your trolls, and then, of course, your gatekeep, which, by the way, are the
right.
worst of the bunch. But with sheeple, I would say 99% of the sheeple that I come across, I meet in person. Across the dinner table at Thanksgiving, the desk next to me at the office, an old high school friend that I haven't seen for years that still go along with the official story and talk about what mainstream media is talking about. And I never met a show in person, someone who is actively defending the official story on behalf of somebody else, technically,
okay.
Whether he's a professional show or an amateur show. The shows you meet online. And so the big thing that I find when people are on these blogs or Facebook or something like that, they're arguing with a shill as if they're talking to a sheeple. In other words, they're trying to convince these people of the truth, and they're spending all this, they're wasting all this time trying to talk to someone whose job it is not to let you believe the truth, you know, and there's no hope for them. So usually I just write them off and I ignore them to whatever extent. Sheeple, on the other hand, because I was one myself, need to be educated, introduced. And rather than throw a lot of, you know, hey, Larry Silverstein and Building 7 and Operation Northwoods and throwing a lot of things you know they won't understand, all that does is discourage them. So what I do is I try to get them to give me the narration. What is it that you know about, you know, 9/11? Are you aware of the 21 hijackers from Iraq that now have 5 buildings? You know, what is it that you know about 9/11? And they finally come to realize that they don't know much beyond the headline. They don't know much beyond the main projected stories. What they are aware of are the consequences, maybe. Where we've gone since then, but they don't really know the story. So sometimes when I'm online, I'll show the FBI picture used in the federal trial of an aerial view of Flight 93, which is just a pit in the ground. And I say, you know, do you know what this picture is? And they can't recognize it. I mean, it's not a train wreck. It's not a bus accident. Is it an airplane crash? Or is it a flood? They can't recognize it. I says, well, according to your story, that's an airplane crash. This is the story that you're defending. And now you're showing me doubt on the very story that it is you're defending. This is the official story here.
Right.
We're told an airplane crashed and this impacted in the ground right here, and there's a man standing in that pit, and yet you don't believe your own story. So rather than trying to sling a lot of technical brouhaha at them and all these facts that is just gonna back them off into a corner, I try to bring them in and let them know what story is that they're defending. Sheeple and shill will defend the same story, but for very different motivations. Are you following me? So they will pronounce the same, they will promote the same headlines, but for a very different reason. The sheeple just don't understand what it is they're defending, so they get frustrated, and you want to avoid that frustration as much as possible. So whenever the topic of 9/11 comes in, I try to let them feed it to me first, you know, because the last thing I want to do is I want to discourage them and just yell at me and go away in this dark end of their beliefs rather than dispel them.
Okay. You do a lot of memes, and I'm going to just say, you've heard me say this a bunch of times, but I'm going to say it for everybody else. Andy made a meme that caught my attention and actually enticed me to put in Boeing 767 being constructed footage in Biggest Lie 14. it's kind of obvious that the airframe of an airplane is just a shell and it's hollow inside. There's no way that this could cause the kind of damage to these steel buildings. They weren't made of, you know, out of drywall or butter or, you know, which we're led to believe that they were flimsy towers because this airplane just goes right through it in the Hezekani shot.
Right.
You know, just slices right through the tower. And there's no parts that are visible falling to the ground, like wings or tail section or, you know. And the plane doesn't crumple or crinkle or get crushed as it hits the wall, assuming there's, like, a huge amount of momentum and it's allowable to say that it would go through the walls of the tower, which I'm 100% sure that this is not possible. But the point being that the airplane is made of aluminum. The tower is made of steel. Also to say that this ductile versus brittle ductile material tends to bend. And so there was no bending taking place in that alleged collision, which was, you know, fed to us through the television. So let's talk about the evidence of the point of impact and what you've done in terms of research on that.
Like I said, the first one that I came across was probably the one that's least talked about, and that's United Flight Airlines 757 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I've actually visited the site during the government shutdown. the park was closed, but I rode my bicycle up in there anyway. And the obviousness that there is just nothing there in that pit, accompanied by the local coroner, Wally, I forgot what his name was, mentioned that there were no bodies there. The mayor said that there were no plane parts. But you can't have a 100-ton airplane impacting the ground at near the speed of sound and leave nothing behind. So that was one of the things. And then the official story, of course, states that the plane was buried 20, 30, 40 feet below the surface. It was excavated out, and the FBI officially stated that 95% of the plane was recovered. Of course, we don't see any of that, and they don't have any pictures of that, and there's no evidence of that beyond just that we're supposed to trust the official story that 95% was recovered. There's a famous picture of the excavator or the backhoe digging out the engine, and that engine is seen 3-4 feet below the surface of the ground. And I thought, well, now, wait a minute. We've got this aluminum plane that is 30 to 40 feet, but the 9-ton engine barely broke the surface. I said,
right.
Why aren't people asking this question? I mean, and if 100 tons of airplane went under the ground because it was a soft soil mine, a surface mine that was refilled with soft soil, and that's the reason why there was no bedrock, okay, fine. But if 100 tons of plane goes under the ground, then 100 tons of soil has to displace it. It has to go somewhere. We're not talking yogurt here, you know, dropping a spoon in a bottle of, you know, a jar of yogurt. We're talking about soil that has to be displaced. And I made one meme that was shown at ground level, and where the official wing print was, we've got tall, dry, brown grass growing in the wing print, which, by the way, carries the majority of the fuel in the plane. And there's no burns, there's no singes or anything like that. So right away I said, no, we're being lied to. Now, I've had some truthers say, well, the plane was actually shot down, and that explains why it was like, well, I said, well, okay, if the plane were shot down, then they would treat it much like the shuttle disaster that exploded in the air over Texas, where they had sheriff's deputies over dozens of counties ordering their citizens not to touch any of the material that they found, not to, you know, just to report where it was, and everything was photographed and everything was collected and put in a barn, and none of that happened in Pennsylvania. There was no warnings, there was no scouring, there's no newspaper reports of evidence being picked up, you know, in an 8 square mile or something like that. I couldn't find any. I couldn't find anything. So the shutdown theory was, you know, that fell apart pretty quickly as far as I'm concerned. So that made me want to look into the other points, you know, the face of the building, the face of the building, or the actual ground where the contact was made. And of course, we see all the debris. People say, what do you mean? Y'all got pictures of debris? Let me show you. And they keep sending me the same pictures, the bandana in the plastic bag, and the unburned passports, and the engine at Murray Street under the scaffolding, and the landing gear in New York under a scaffolding, by the way. And, you know, all these debris. I'm smiling. You can show me 100 pieces of debris, 1,000 pieces of debris in all these location B areas. But all debris found in location B must first pass through location A. If not, then it comes from location C, which could be a warehouse, a pickup truck, who knows where it came from. Okay. And like the fuselage part on the top of the building, see right there, there's the fuselage on top of the building, one solitary piece standing by itself, you know, almost in a pristine condition. I say, well, if that plane went through the building, that would look like an accordion that was crushed under a pickup truck. That would, I can see three windows in that piece of fuselage, and you want me to believe that came through a steel building?
Right.
Oh, my voice doesn't go out. And then, of course, the Pentagon debris and all the Pentagon in location B, you have these isolated little individual pieces here and here and here, all by themselves. And then when you compare that to actual airplane crash videos, there is a massive debris, just an absolutely massive debris scattered all over of all kinds of sizes, and pieces with wires hanging out of it, and fuel damage and everything like that. And then there is the interior ring of interior ring C in the Pentagon, where the mysterious round hole was. And they say, here, look at, there's debris right here. There's debris right here. And I say, yeah, that's interesting. Now, how much energy would it take to create that hole? That's a pretty powerful blast. And yet all the debris you're showing me looks like it oozed out like liquid. Like, just flow, and it's all piled in this one nice little neat pile, as if a dump truck had dumped it off. And that debris would just be spread out like the wall would. You know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. So that takes me back to location A on each of the impact zones. So I looked at Flight 11 on the North Tower, the first plane that hit, and there are probably 50 or 60 different photographs of that impact zone. And then Flight 175 on the South Tower. And as you scan with close-ups and you enlarge the pictures and you look at the one impact zone where actually there's 9 columns right in a row at the edge of the left wing that aren't completely penetrated. They're just bent in. And yet there's no plane debris, zero, zilch, donuts, baby. There's nothing. There's not one piece of plane debris wedged in there. Now, if I were to take a wing and throw it into a building, it would be like a cheese grater. It would be like a hard-boiled egg slicer. The wings would go in there, and they would impact, and they would stick in there, or they would fall out. There would be some debris behind. So how is it that these engines, these parts can go through this building but not leave anything at the impact zone? The same thing can be said at the Pentagon. There's one wall where the left wing hits, and they see the fascia of the building is all broken away. That's where the wing hits. I say, okay, so the wall is not penetrated. There's no debris impacted in the wall. There's no debris at the base of the wall. So where did it go? Where did the wing go? And you know, did it just fold up and follow the fuselage in? You have to have. It's not so much. It's not so much the absence of evidence as the evidence of the absence. It's just not there. So I don't know. I've never claimed to be a planer or a no planer. That's the arguments I usually try to avoid, like I mentioned before. But I sure am a no debriser, and I can't find one piece of debris at any point of impact on any of those crashes. And and I focus on it. And when I get into these discussions with people, I have to keep coming back to that point because, like I say, any debris found in location B must first pass through location A. And at location A, there must be evidence that a plane had hit there, and I haven't seen that yet. So that's kind of the stand I take on, and that's the premise I work on. And if something can counter that premise, you know, I'll follow along. But until then, I haven't been able to follow that. So.
Yeah, I mean, they're really, based on the amount of research you've done on it, it's like the probability of ever finding evidence that corroborates the official story is very low. And,
most of it's been destroyed. Most of it's been destroyed too, you know. Conveniently, the cameras are always being turned off. You know, I mean, well, that just happened in Nice now. You know, where the mayor has been ordered to destroy all the photographic evidence of the truck going through the crowd at Nice. You know, I mean, isn't that convenient? Yeah. But as far as people saying, well, show us the evidence. Well, when the evidence is destroyed, the steel goes to China and et cetera, like that, then, you know, we're left at a disadvantage, of course. But we've been lied to. Say again?
It's purposeful. This is no accident. It's purposeful. It's like you got to look at it like, why do they only show one camera view of the Pentagon in 5 frames. I actually want to talk about that for a sec.
Okay.
So in the full video of the Pentagon footage from that guard shack, just after the hit, there's an SUV that drives in through the gate, and it makes a right turn in front of the Pentagon, and it
over by the
drives
heliport?
Out onto it drives out onto the field, and my only assumption that seems to fit is there's a picture that shows a couple of people picking up a piece of the front part of the nose of the plane, and it looks like it was cut out sheet metal. You know, like it looks like the plane, but there's no scarring and there's no damage to it. It's all just cut out, you know? And there's like 3 guys picking up this piece of aluminum.
Right.
And I personally feel like that was planted by that SUV. It's an assumption, but I'm pretty damn sure that's the case. So, want to talk about the Pentagon for a bit?
Well, yeah. And again, the Pentagon is real incredible. I mean, the official story states that Hani Hanjour, a nincompoop failed student pilot, somehow commandeered, Captain, what's his name, Burlingame, who was a military combat veteran and also a trainer for pilots in hijacking. Somehow they overpowered him. And if you look at the cockpit of these planes, can you imagine pulling a 6-foot-plus guy out of that cockpit seat and dragging him across the console and dead limp body to get him out of there? 5-foot-5 Hani Hanjour. I mean, first of all, the scenario is just so incredible. And then to sit down and say, okay, I'm gonna crash this plane into something, and then take the most improbable course to get there. Then as he drops 6,000-7,000 feet in this corkscrew dive, we are told that he hits about 5 telephone poles. And, of course, the one telephone pole that went into Lloyd England's car, Lloyd England claims that the end of the car impacted right through the windshield and landed, you know, impacting the back seat, and yet there's no other damage to the hood of the car or anything like that. The other 4 poles were conveniently lying down on the road out of space. They're all on a hill or an incline away from the hill that led to the projected flight into the Pentagon. One of the poles, I think it was the second pole, actually went opposite the edge of the flight. But my question would be, okay, the plane hitting those poles at the alleged 500 plus miles an hour is like a lawnmower hitting a nail in the yard. And it's just the nail is just going to tip over. No, that wing would shear off because of the sheer force of that wing. You know, I mean, the laws of physics states that an airplane hitting those poles at 500 miles an hour would be the same as a pole hitting the plane at 500 miles an hour. Either the pole is going to, you know, is going to be decimated. They're not going to just lie over a few feet from their base. They're going to be flung hundreds of yards. I mean, they're going to be carried away. They have a hard time finding the damn thing. So the whole pole scenario is very strange. And the fact that the plane would have to come to a descent, very steep descent, level out suddenly in order to get to the flight. So the flight trajectory comes under severe question just on the physical evidence that the official story brings into it. And then, of course, the flight that hit the only part of the building that had been recently remodeled, to protect against bomb explosives. It kind of matches the same story as the towers that the floors that were hit by the towers were the floors that were recently gone through fireproofing. Isn't that interesting?
Right.
So I thought that was very interesting too. But the fact that the plane, we were told the plane crashed into impact, went through the 3 contiguous floors. The first and second floor are contiguous from the exterior E-ring to the interior C-ring. A lot of people think that went through, you know, 3 series of concrete walls, but the first 2 floors is all one big room for the outside 3 rings. So that's a mistake that I think a lot of people make. When we look at the aftermath of the pictures, when they started reconstruction, you look at the floor of that impact was, and the concrete is perfectly smooth. There's no damage. And of course there's that stool with the book, open book up on the third floor that wasn't burned or anything like that. And if you compare that impact with what we're told happened at the towers, where the explosion bike took out 5 floors of that steel building.
Right.
And yet here in the Pentagon, it's confined to just a very, very small impact point. And then again, the people who are defending the story say, well, you can see on the building where the tail hit, you know, see the paint is chipped off. Okay, the paint is chipped off. Or the spool on the ground is dented just where the engine went in. Well, okay, that's the right engine. How come the left engine is projected to go into the ground and we don't see it burrowing into there, you know? So the whole thing is absolutely preposterous. It's just absolutely preposterous. And, of course, the cameras are off, and then the argument they give me is, well, the cameras were supposed to be pointed at the sky. You know, that's where airplanes come from. And I say, well, yeah, that's true. They were probably pointed at the sky where airplanes come from. But don't you remember they hit the damn telephone poles 14 feet above the ground? Then you're telling me they're not going to get that? You know, your argument doesn't make any sense. Yeah, on
they confiscated all the video.
Oh yeah, and the Sheraton Hotel and the Cisco gas station and everything else that you know they were all confiscated and gone and Special Agent Jacqueline McGuire, who was in charge of reviewing all the films gave a document saying, you know, we reviewed all these films and there's no evidence here that will help us determine the cause of the crash or what happened. So by now, I wouldn't even make an attempt to be open to some kind of revolution. It happened, and you know, the whole government was taken over by somebody else. But that's just preposterous. And also, speaking of cameras, I mean, we have Dulles Airport, we have Newark Airport, and Boston Airport, and that there are no video cameras, there are no videos of the passengers, the alleged hijackers, entering the plane, sitting at the gate, going through the hall, and things. There is one video that they purport were some of the hijackers coming through security and being checked. But it was conveniently that the timestamp somehow disappeared. There was no timestamp on it. So that video could have been taken any time. You know, that could have been taken any time. And the vision and the faces were so blurry, they could have been anybody. So that doesn't really hold much water either. And oddly enough, the same company, the same security company that managed Boston, Newark, and Dulles, we're probably, in cahoots on this too, because they're the ones that have to manage the security system. And that was, an Israeli company, by the way. So I think that's very suspect right there to begin with, that the videos are so out of there. There's just nothing available that concrete video that proves the official story true.
I want to run this by you.
Sure.
Does it occur to you that in every scenario on 9/11, it's preposterous, and they feed us a lie, and we bought it? And so in retrospect, do you think they were testing our wits, our mental stamina, to see through the lie, or to prove that we are collectively all really fucking stupid?
Well, you know, you go back to the Murrow Building in Oklahoma and the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, and they knew long before 9/11 that as long as the media cooperates, and the government sheds its, you know, mournful tears and eulogizes and puts up patriotic flags and support our troop banners and things like that, they know that the vast majority of people in this country are going to go along with it. They're going to go along with it because by challenging the government, the whole, like I say, house of cards would start to fall down. And their approach is a thing that most people who study 9/11, a term called cognitive dissonance that has become familiar, it's possible to take place. Cognitive dissonance basically means a conscious conflict. Cognitive dissonance cannot happen until someone is shown unmitigating truth that what they knew was wrong, and they've made the conscious decision to still deny it and go back into their comfortable state. So some people would rather live a comfortable life than a horrible truth. And so the government, or who's ever in charge of the government, realizes that it's a crapshoot, but they have won so far every event. I mean, you look at Sandy Hook, Boston, Chattanooga, Umpqua Community College, Charleston, Orlando, it goes on and on and on. These scenarios happen, and they know that people are going to buy it and believe it.
Right.
And so I don't know if 9/11 was really the test case. 9/11 was just the ultimate act of treason, and people are afraid. They're afraid to, what can I say, contemplate the consequences of that. You know, there's something that the people call a core conviction or a core belief or a core faith, and the term core, meaning center, is really the key issue. And from that core, we have all these tentacles, these strings, and these attachments, and these chains, and these links, and these pillars, and these suspension cables, all these things that are connected to the core, which relate to religion and spiritual and economic and philosophical and domestic and communal and political and professional things, all the things in your life that are connected to this core belief have to be an agreement with that core belief. Some of them are stronger than others. So when someone is talking about 9/11, you're attacking my core belief, but maybe you're really attacking my political views or my religious views or my support to troops views. You're really attacking that through the back door by attacking the core, my core belief. And once someone is challenged, that they've been shown evidence, unquestionable evidence, that what they thought was true is not true, then that cognitive dissonance comes in. Because once people realize that, geez, once I have to extinguish this core belief, all those connections, all those tethers and strings and chains and links that I held true with everything in my life, those have to change too. I can't maintain those thoughts about, you know, the government and politics and the banking system and the education system and vaccines and everything else if that core belief is no longer there. So it puts people in this crazy mental disarray that they don't know. They're lost. Suddenly they're lost. And then they start realizing that once they do become conscious of it and they want to pursue the truth, and of course they make all the same mistakes that we all made when we were new truthers. Now they find themselves in the awkward position that they are the same person that they used to accuse of being crazy. And now exactly. The people that they want to introduce this to are going to be treating them like they used to treat others. So it's right. even when people are full swing into the proposition that we were lied to and that it was an inside job, they're still hesitant to carry out it further. So we are remaining, you know, in a small minority. And as time goes on, and we look now, there aren't many survivors of World War II. They're dying out there. The World War I's all gone, you know. Even Vietnam soldiers now are limping around and getting gray and old and dying. There will be a time when no one will be alive that remembers 9/11. And that's a shocking thought because if this Orwellian precept keeps falling, you know, down on our heads, you know, it will be a truth, you know, that will just... The lie becomes a truth, and the truth becomes a lie, and there will be no escape. And that's why, when people say, "Oh, it's 15 years ago, so what?" You know, I say even more reason, why we should keep this alive and keep the fire stoking.
Yeah, man, I hear you absolutely 100%. Well, listen, that was an excellent show. I learned some stuff from you, and it was good. We should do